It's time for the best coverage of the top stories in sports. The Sports Wrap with Jason Page starts now.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Chad Erickson, and great to have you with us on this Monday edition of the show. Now coming to you from Las Vegas. I know, it looks almost exactly the same, but just so you know, the show now emanates from Vegas, baby. Looking forward to bringing the show to you from the Strip, or close to it. We start things out in the Olympics today. Sam Yarnell is here. Patrick McEnroe drops by in about 10 minutes. Spend a couple of segments with him on the Olympics tennis and anything else he wants to talk about. It's Patrick McEnroe. We let him talk about what he wants to. Sam Yarnell, an Olympics weekend. We could literally spend the entire hour on the Olympics, but we're not going to because there's a lot of places you can get that. But we got to talk about Simone Biles and Scottie Scheffler shining this weekend. And in the case of Biles, just continuing to do amazing things. And I think starting to open the door to at least the conversation, greatest athlete ever, period, full stop. Like, where do you start to put this? And I know it gets tricky. It gets tricky when we start trying to compare sports and different athletes and different sizes and different shapes and different eras and all of that. But, I mean, what she has done in these games, and people don't realize, for a gymnast, she's on the, quote, older side. I'll say one more thing, Sam. There's no guarantee this is her last Olympics, by the way. There's no guarantee this is her last Olympics. You're going to tell me in 3 years she ain't going to get the itch and perhaps say, I'm going to even one-up myself and come back in another 4 years. Put that aside if you want for now and just talk about what she did this weekend.
Well, yeah, I'm gonna be honest. I'm not deep enough into the gymnastics world to know if it's unheard of.
Can for you do a split?
No, I can't. I guarantee you that. But I don't know how realistic it is for a 31-year-old to compete in the Olympics. Like, I don't have a grasp of if that's feasible or just not. What I do know is that Simone Biles, I think before this Olympics, was the most decorated gymnast in history. And she only went out and won 3 golds and a silver at this Olympics already. And I think there's still, no, the gymnastics is now over. Yes. So 3 golds, 1 silver. On top of being the most decorated gymnast of all time. Yeah, at 27 years old, I'll take Simone Biles. Definitely in the conversation for greatest athlete of all time. Knocking on the door before this Olympics, she has kicked the door down during this Olympics, and she's right there with Serena Williams and Michael Phelps and Tiger Woods and all of these other goats in their sport. I'm ready to put Simone Biles right there. I don't know about athlete of all time because, you know, Phelps has what, the 27 Olympic golds or whatever
it
feels
like it.
It's some stupid number. It is in the 20s. I don't know if 27 is correct. But regardless, Simone Biles, absolute dominance, the GOAT, and she proved in this Olympics, Jason, why she has earned that nickname rightfully.
Boy, and you think about 4 years ago, in Tokyo, you know, with the twisties and putting her mental health first and taking a step back, she got crushed in the media. I mean, she really took a beating. And you want to talk about silencing your critics. You want to talk about laying the hammer down with the ultimate mic drop if this is indeed the end for her in her Olympic career. Simone Biles certainly put it all together this weekend. She did finish with a silver, so she didn't get the, quote, golden send-off that she would have liked, but certainly a fantastic weekend.
Oh, my God. We can't say 3 golds. I mean, that's plenty.
She was outstanding. All right, let's talk about Scottie Scheffler.
She is the greatest athlete of all time because we were just talking about how it may not have been the send-off she'd like because she didn't sweep the board and win gold in every event she competed in. That's impressive. Maybe you're right, Jason. Maybe she is the greatest athlete of all time.
It'll certainly be open for discussion. And that, and the other thing that I think is interesting, we don't have enough time to talk about it, is sort of what you do after you're an Olympian. because it's not like tennis or golf where they just go back to playing their regular tours. There is no tour for gymnastics the way there is for golf and tennis. But anyway, it's another topic for another time. Scottie Scheffler wins Olympic gold, I think seals it as golfer of the year with that gold medal. Xander Schauffele had his opportunity. Everybody was bunched up going into that final round, and we could have started to have a debate about a further debate of Schauffele versus Scheffler for player of the year, especially if Schauffele had been able to pull it off and win a gold or even get a better medal spot than Scheffler. But Scottie Scheffler just doing Scottie Scheffler things yet again when it comes to hitting a golf ball into a small hole.
Incredible. 8 under in the final round, or yeah. 9 under, whatever. No, 8 under. He needed to birdie 18 to finish 9 under. So much to take away from this golf tournament, Jason. Scottie Scheffler is the best golfer in the world. I apologize to the viewers and listeners for coming on this program before the Olympics after Xander Schauffele was dominant in the last major. I came on here and I said, hey, you know, if Scottie doesn't do well in the Olympics, you know, we got a real conversation on our hands about who is the best golfer this year, and it might be Xander. He's got 2 majors. Scottie's only got 1, you know. If Scottie doesn't finish top half in the Olympics, no. No. And it looked like that, right? The first three rounds of this tournament, I, along with everybody else in the media, had written off Scottie Scheffler. All right, wasn't his week. He tried, whatever. An 8 under final round is incredible. Winning Olympic gold, the choke job from Jon Rahm.
Oh.
Listen to this, Jason. All Jon Rahm needed to do on the back nine of the final round, despite whatever Scottie Scheffler did, all Jon Rahm had to do was shoot even par, and he would have won gold outright by a stroke. And Scottie Scheffler came in, busted the door down. Jon Rahm didn't even finish on the podium. Just horrible, horrible, horrible stuff from Jon Rahm. Great job, Scottie Scheffler. He's the best in the world. The most impressive part about all this, Jason, this was a week where Scottie Scheffler lost strokes to the field putting. He lost strokes to the field putting. The putter was not there this week. Goes out in the final round and nails every putt. Incredible stuff.
I just wish he wasn't golf's version of Gomer Pyle. I just wish he excited me more. Sometimes good golf has to be exciting enough, I guess. But gee whiz. Gee whiz.
Jeepers.
Jeepers. Guy's an amazing golfer. Nothing left to say. We're coming back with Patrick McEnroe.
I'd like to say this is the first time, but there have been others.
How many?
Who can keep track?
You think this is a joke?
Darling, we need answers, and you're going to give them to us.
Tell us again.
My car broke down. I brought it here.
I got stuck paying an expensive repair bill.
So it's true.
How much, darling?
$2,300.
$2,300?
Well, what was I supposed to do? My transmission was shot.
You pick up your phone and you call CarShield before the car breaks down.
Plans through CarShield cover up to 5,000 parts and systems in your car.
That's right. A plan through CarShield could save you on some criminally high auto repairs, especially if your car is out of warranty. So, call CarShield, America's number one auto protection company, before a breakdown and save yourself from getting stuck in car repair jail.
Let me guess. You hate saving money.
Who hates saving money?
Apparently you do.
All you had to do was call CarShield. And you could have protected yourself against expensive repairs.
Yeah, and then my price will go up the minute I file a claim.
Shut up! CarShield has the price locked in.
For as long as you cover your car.
I guess I should have called CarShield?
Ha! It's about time you said something that made sense.
Now you know what you need to do next time.
Bet he'll call CarShield now.
So can I go? Or
CarShield has an A rating with the Better Business Bureau and was voted America's most trusted auto protection company. Don't get handcuffed paying expensive auto repairs. Call now and get the CarShield guarantee. Your price will never go up and your coverage will never go down as long as you cover your car. In just minutes, you could have a plan that covers up to 5,000 parts and systems in your car. Don't wait until it's too late. Get CarShield's best coverage yet. Call 800-722-6574.
Attention families with a loved one in a nursing home. If your loved one has suffered from bed sores, falls, broken bones, dehydration, or even death, you may be entitled to a substantial settlement. If you have a loved one who was injured in a nursing home, we will find out what happened. State violations are found against nursing homes every day. You have a limited time to file your claim, so don't wait. Call 800-398-5999 and speak with one of our attorneys. The call is confidential and free.
Sports Wrap continues. Great to have you with us on this Monday edition of the show. Sam Yarnell will be by in about 10 minutes to join the conversation with this guy, Patrick McEnroe, ESPN tennis commentator, president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and man that appears just about everywhere on your television. If you're not seeing him here, you're seeing him somewhere else. Boy, I tell you, I was dreaming that we'd get an Alcaraz-Djokovic final in these Olympic Games, and boy, did it live up to the billing, didn't it?
You know, it was a tremendous performance by Djokovic. I felt going into the match, Jason, that pretty much a perfect storm had to happen for him to win. And that's saying something because he's the all-time great. He's the greatest ever. But he is 37. He hadn't won a tournament all year. You know, Sinner roughed him up in Australia in the semifinals there where he really didn't show up for the first couple of sets, which was unusual. Then, of course, he kind of was mailing it in for most of the year until he got to the French. Then he started to get it together. Looked like the game, the motivation was back, and then he suffers the knee injury, has to pull out, shows up at Wimbledon 4 weeks after having meniscus surgery, which obviously couldn't have been that serious, right? Every surgery serious, but he managed to get to the final and then just got blown away by Alcaraz. So now you get the rematch a couple of weeks later on clay, back at Roland Garros, and I think the fact that it was on clay was better for Djokovic because it slowed things down a little bit. You know, Alcaraz was able to punish him with his power and his speed and his athleticism at Wimbledon. And this kind of slowed things down a bit so where Novak could kind of use his guile, use his shots from all parts of the court. He wasn't overwhelmed, you know, physically by the sheer pace of the Alcaraz game. And, you know, Alcaraz had a lot of opportunities. They both did. Djokovic was 0-6 on break points. Alcaraz was 0-8 in the match, so there were no breaks, which on clay is very unusual. And then just Novak stepped up in the breakers and played phenomenal. It was, as I said, I think so many things had to go right for him to win that. And I also believe that 2 out of 3 favored Djokovic because I think that he could kind of come out with a mindset early of like, I got to go big early. And I tweeted at one point, you know, he's emptying the bucket. What I meant by that is like every ounce of his physical and mental strength was going into every single point in this match. Whereas I think if it was best of 5, I'm not sure he would have been able to have that same intensity throughout. But it was amazing to see. And you could tell by his reaction and his comments after the match, you know, how much this meant to him and arguably was maybe the biggest win of his life.
Well, that's kind of what I want to ask you, because they had this conversation in golf yesterday in the Twitter sphere, X sphere, whatever you want to call it on social media, about whether it should almost count as a major, you know, whether it is almost like a slam. Is this like that? But or because of the fact that it's not best of 5, which the slams are, do you give it the same weight?
Well, I do. I think tennis has become more and more important for the players, and that's who I look at the most. You know, the players' reactions and how their focus is going in. You know, people say, well, what about the American guys that didn't show up at the Olympics, like that went to play in D.C. instead? Mm-hmm. Like, Korda, who won it, Tiafo. Well, those guys didn't have a chance to win a medal, basically. So that's why, you know, if that was on grass, they would have played, okay? So that was a surface decision. But for the European players especially, Jason, tennis in the Olympics has become massive. And I think even seeing the American, two American men's doubles teams got medals, a silver and a bronze, and how much it means to them. So I think, of course, tennis and golf have the four majors, and everybody talks about that when you say, how many majors did Tiger win? How many majors did Serena win? You know, you don't, but the Olympics becomes, oh, also they won an Olympic gold. You know, when you talk about Nadal, for example, he's won gold in singles. Federer won gold in doubles in the Olympics. So that becomes like another part of the equation, but it is different. You're right. And I don't think it's because it's best two out of three. I just think because it's not a major. If it were best of five, would that make a difference? Not really. Not to me, it wouldn't. I love the majors being best of five, but I don't have any problem with the Olympics being best two out of three. By the way, not only was this a great match, remember when they played at Wimbledon years ago when Andy Murray won the gold, There were some epic matches in the semis and finals there, all involving Federer, Djokovic, Del Potro, and Murray.
What's wrong with Coco Gauff?
You know, I don't know if there's a whole lot wrong with her. I mean, she's still two in the world, okay, Jason, and I don't need to remind you.
No, but there's something wrong here. We just saw it in the Wimbledon semifinal.
I think your expectations are too high. If you want me to be honest, she's not Serena. She's not as good as Serena.
But she wants to be.
Well, I'd like to be too. I mean, I'd like to be as good as my brother. You know, I worked my ass off. But some, you know, look, I'm not saying Coco's not going to have a great career, a Hall of Fame career. I believe she will. But
is there something in the mental game for her against Pauline?
No, it's not the mental game. No, it's not mental. It's technical. It's the forehand swing, and it's the second serve. And even though those things have gotten better, and Brad Gilbert helped her last year by focusing on the positive, like, you know, look at all the things you do well. The backhand's great. Her athleticism, obviously, off the charts. It's not that her forehand is bad, Jason. It's just not reliable consistently under pressure. Okay, sometimes it is, but not all the time. You know, most great players, they're best. They might lose and they might miss some shots, but their shots don't break down under pressure. You know, Serena lost, but it wasn't because of a technical flaw in her game at some point. So Coco has those. It's very hard for any coach, whether it's Brad Gilbert or anyone else, to go back to the drawing board and fix the swing, right? So you have to tinker with it. You have to play with it. It's a little bit like recreating your golf swing, right? You hear about pros doing that. It's a little more doable in golf because there's so much technique and, you know, the ball's not moving in the same way as it is in tennis. But Coco's two in the world. So don't interrupt me again on this, Jason. She's two in the world. She's had very consistent results. But yes, she's lacking the big result thus far in a major. She did get to the semis of the French where, you know, Swiatek is better than her on clay. And so I think her confidence is not where it was. And she's got a lot of points to defend now for the rest of this summer. So her ranking, if she doesn't defend the Open, she could easily fall out of the top five.
All right, we're coming back. Stay with us. All right, let's take it to segment three on this Monday. Continue the conversation with my man Patrick McEnroe. Hangs out with us. And we bring Sam Yarnell into the mix as well. Sam went and watched tennis this weekend, so now he's a tennis expert. He's got to talk about. He texted me. He texted me over the weekend, just to say I went to the DC Open and this happened, and I was so upset. Can I just close the book on this Coco Gauff thing? Not because I have to have the last word or anything like that. Just because we were talking about it, and we talked about it a little going to the break. My concern with her is sort of what I saw mentally from her at the end of that French Open match against Paulini, and then our Wimbledon match against Paulini, and then here at the French Open. That was more my concern, is there something in her mental game that's holding her back? That was my only, that was my question/point.
First of all, you mean what just happened at the Olympics,
which was at the sight
of the French Open.
Yes.
But I get your point. I think she's feeling the pressure. I mean, you know, she got the big one winning the Open last year, and then the expectations changed. So now it's like, if you don't win a major, is it an unsuccessful year for, you know, Pete Sampras used to say, a good year for me is winning a major, right? One major. A great year is winning two majors. That's what he used to say. You know, I don't know if Coco can set the bar that high. I mean, Djokovic in the last 8-10 years would say, a good year for me is winning two majors. A great year is winning three. I mean, that's how crazy it's been. But I think Coco will be fine. I don't think she's going to be, you know, a dominant number one. I don't see that happening. I think it's too tight at the top. But I think she'll be okay. I'm not sure. Again, she's got a lot of points to defend in the next month, having won Washington, which she obviously didn't play this year because of the Olympics. She won in Cincinnati as well, and she won the U.S. Open. So that's a lot of points to defend.
All right. Sam has had a vision. He's become Bud Collins, and he wants to talk tennis.
Cut
the line.
I just want to say, just really quickly, I'm so glad you brought the Coco Gauff point up, Jason, because I think that as much as like you and I talked on this show last week when the Olympic meltdown kind of, if we'll call it that, kind of started to happen, we're all just forgetting that this woman is not even 21 years old yet. I mean, she's just past 20 years old and has such a long... I think it's so funny, Jason, that you and I were sitting here talking about, you know, mental fortitude and all this stuff. Yeah, she's not even 21. Of course, she may not have the most mental fortitude. She's got so long to grow into the game. And she's already been playing since she was at the professional level since she was, what, 18, 17, something like that?
Sorry, 15.
Yeah, 15. I remember. Right. I remember her debut at Wimbledon when she was 15.
When she beat Venus, 15. Yeah.
Incredible to me that she's had as illustrious career as she has, and she's still so young. You mentioned Washington, Patrick, and obviously a great tournament, has moved up from the 250 to the 500 in recent years. And it's a great tournament on the lower level that I think is very fun for, you know, casual tennis fans like Jason is alluding to, like myself, to go out and see some all-time greats, but also see some up-and-comers. Interesting thing transpired this weekend between Ben Shelton and Denis Shapovalov. Tiebreak in the second set. Shelton with triple match point. Shapovalov frustrated with himself in a long back and forth match. Yells something at a fan that was allegedly heckling him or whatever the case may be. The chair umpire issues him a warning and then calls over the supervisor. Now, we've seen at major tournaments players throw or hit balls at fans, go on illustrious cursing rants towards spectators, and only receive this warning now in a smaller level tournament between these two big names in DC. You have all this happen. What was your main takeaway from what happened on Friday afternoon in Washington?
Well, a few things to respond to, Sam. First of all, let me just correct you very slightly. If you hit a ball into the crowd or if you hit a fan with the ball, you're automatically defaulted. That's what happened, or someone on the court. That's what happened to Djokovic a couple of years ago at the U.S. Open. He hit the ball in anger, and it hit the lineswoman in the head, and he was defaulted on the spot. So that's a relatively new rule. You know, if you loft the ball into the crowd, like you hit it up in the air, you're just going to get a warning. But if you hit it like in anger to hit somebody, which, by the way, Shapovalov did years ago in the Davis Cup match when he was a teenager, he smacked the ball as hard as he could trying to send it into the crowd. He hit the umpire in the eye. And the umpire actually had to have surgery, okay? So let me get to what happened in D.C. First of all, Shelton was about to win the match. He was a triple match point, and he was about to serve. So he had two serves, so it's highly likely he was going to win it. Now, I didn't hear, maybe you did because you were there, what Shapovalov said to the fan. But I'm guessing because of the way it transpired, as you said, the umpire went to the supervisor. It was something pretty bad. And usually when you see that happen, they confer, then they decide, is that enough to warrant an automatic default on the spot? Because if you say something, you know, totally outrageous to a Lions person or a fan, you can get that can be aggravated behavior and you can get defaulted on the spot with no warning. But let me say this about Shapovalov, because I'm worried about this guy, because I've known him pretty well. OK, and I've seen him for many years. We had him on our Laver Cup team a couple of times. He's got some anger issues. Okay, so this to me was way beyond whether they made the right call. This was like, this guy loses his marbles way more than he should on the court. And this has been a huge part of, in my opinion, his problem on why he's dropped out of the top 100. And, you know, because he's got the talent to be a consistent top 15, top 10 player. So he's got some issues that I've feel that he's got to deal with that he's not dealing with, anger issues, controlling his emotions, etc. So in a way, I was happy to see him defaulted because maybe he'll get the message that, you know, he needs some help and he needs to like control himself. He's doing stuff like this, Sam, all the time to his coaches, to himself, to, you know, people in the crowd. And he's got to find a way to reel it in a big way. So if you have anything to add about what happened specifically, I saw the highlights. I couldn't really figure out exactly what he said, but I was happy they defaulted him.
Patrick, can I hold you for one more real quick? Because I just want to ask you a couple more things about the Olympics. Sammy Arnell's hanging out with me and Patrick McEnroe. We're going to do one more segment with Patrick. We've bolted him to the chair. He's agreed to hang around for one more segment as we continue Sports Wrap on this Monday. All right, little bonus segment with Patrick McEnroe. Why? Because why not? He's got nothing better to do.
I'm that good on your show. I need to get a bonus segment. That's
got,
why.
Because you got nothing better to do. Come on, it's Monday. What are you going to do today?
I got a lot to do today. I got to go to our tennis academy and check out the kids, and then I'm going to get pumped for the Olympics. I already did my TV appearance early this morning, so I got to work out. Jason, right. I got to pick up my dog. I mean, come on, man. I got to work out too.
I
got Sam over here.
I got the new studio here in Vegas. We got the new setup. I got a gym now that I can go use. I got to get in shape.
I love it.
Got a basketball court right outside my door. It's fantastic. So within like 6 months, I'm going to look completely different. Okay. All right. So we talked about what happened in DC. I want to get your thought sort of as we get ready to go into the – I want to ask you one thing about the Olympics, so I want to be quick on this. As we get ready for the U.S. Open, we saw – to go back to where we started with Djokovic, obviously, getting the win. How do you handicap the U.S. Open right now with where Djokovic is? From a health perspective, obviously, he's getting stronger. We obviously know what Alcaraz has done, where Sinner's game is. How do you handicap the men's side of the U.S. Open?
I would put Alcaraz as a slight favorite, Djokovic next, probably Sinner right there. And obviously some of it will depend on Sinner's playing this week in Canada. So is Medvedev, so is Zverev. I think both those guys have a shot. They would be the next two in line. I feel like Zverev's played well enough in the last 24 months that he sort of almost deserves to win one. He's been that close, obviously, at the French, five sets. You know, he's going to be a factor. Medvedev always on hard courts. That's his best shot. But right now, if you're a Djokovic fan, you got to be thinking, you know, this is a major boost. He's not, I'd be surprised if he shows up for Cincinnati. He's not going to play Canada, which starts today. Maybe he'll play Cincinnati, but I think he just shows up in New York, you know, now that he's got the Olympic win under his belt and he'll be good to go. But I still think Alcaraz, with his overall firepower, is a slight favorite, but very close between those three guys.
What else has stood out to you from these Olympic games, Patrick?
You know, it was nice to see Zhang win for China. I mean, you know, she's been an awesome player. I think she can win some majors too. She made the Aussie Open final. She's very athletic. You know, China has poured a lot into tennis in the last 20, 30 years since tennis became an Olympic sport again. That's why China got so big into tennis. So it was good to see them get, you know, her get the reward and win it. Li Na, of course, won a couple majors back in the day. Still waiting for like that big time male player from China. They've got a couple of guys now that are at least in the top 100. But overall, it was just a Herculean effort by Djokovic to win it. And happy to see the American men get two medals in doubles,
yeah,
you know, a silver and a bronze. So that was cool.
Outside of the tennis, what has stood out to you most?
You know, I'm a big gymnastics. I love the big stories. The guy with the glasses, a Clark Kent.
The pommel horse,
he's been my favorite because, you know, like his vibe, just sitting there and then he jumps up and he does the pommel horse. And I love the reaction when he finished his routine, when they knew the team. This was back early in the Olympics when the team was going to win the bronze, because for the men, that's a monumental effort. And to see, you know, there was an African-American guy, there's an Asian guy, there's a white guy, there's a pump, and they're all, you know, get together and hug. And like, to me, that's what the Olympics is supposed to be about, right? The team and, you know, putting all of our differences aside, and sports is what's supposed to bring us together. The swimming's been phenomenal as well. I love the swimming. I'm a big water polo guy. I mean, I don't know where I can find it because it's Stanford. When I went to Stanford, I had some buddies that played water polo. They're like Olympic athletes at Stanford, you know, swimmers and water. Those guys were ripped, man. To play water polo, you know, you have to swim the entire time. These guys are like 6'6", absolutely ripped, and then partying all night. I don't know how they did it, but it was fun. It's fun to watch them. I used to go watch water polo before the football game. At Stanford on a Saturday, we'd go watch the water polo. We were way better in water polo, trust me, than in football at Stanford.
Patrick, you mentioned Zhang with the big win in the Olympics. Huge price on her to win the U.S. Open in New York coming up in, oh, wow, just about a month. Do you think there's any value 30-1 plus 3,000? What do we feel like? Does Zhang have a chance to go deep in this tournament, or is hardcourt not where she's going to thrive?
No, she definitely has a chance. She made the final the Australian. So I would that's not a bad bet at all. I'm actually surprised the odds are that long on her. I'm guessing Swiatek's still the favorite, although she's not going to be as strong of a favorite on hard that she is on clay. I'm going to say the second favorite, I don't know, you see it there, Sam. I'm going to say probably Sabalenka second, or maybe Coco third. Right,
Iga and Sabalenka have the same odds. They're both 3-1. Coco is next at plus 650.
That's what I figured. Okay, so then Navarro, you know, had a good run when she beat Coco at Wimby. You know, she could make a run. I don't think any of the Americans are favorites to win it, but I wouldn't be expected if there were two American women like in the semifinals or better at the tournament. Navarro, Collins, Keys has played pretty well this year. Obviously Coco being the favorite, but it's hard to pick. I mean, the men's is more top heavy. The women, there's still, you could have someone even outside the top 20 win it.
I was mad, and I'm not going to lie, I was mad that the golf and tennis final were on at the same time yesterday. I know they got to get all these events in, but man, I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to be able to watch one or the other, not have to go
split
back
screens
and forth. Oh, it was terrible. I had to go back and forth on all of them.
Where was the golf on? What station was it on? It's hard to find.
Golf Channel.
I think it was Golf Channel. I'm pretty sure it was Golf Channel. Okay. We got to run. The one thing we could all agree on, we've all seen way too much pole vaulting on social media. Can we all just agree on that? I think we can all agree on that. Patrick, always appreciate it, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Good seeing you guys. Thanks for having me.
We're coming back. All right, we keep it moving on this Monday edition of the show. Thanks to Patrick McEnroe for hanging out with us for a bonus segment. Three segments with Patrick today on the show. Sam Yarnell. Time for something to consider. All right, Sam, something to consider. Let's go through the National League and American League. We'll start with the NL, talk about a little bit of what we saw this weekend. Obviously, starting with Blake Snell, who since the last time we talked threw a no-hitter. Hey, decided to show up. He's healthy. He's starting to pitch well, right in time for the offseason. Got hot at the right time. It's like when I bowl bad for 2.5 games. You bowl 3 games in league. You bowl terrible the first 2 games. And then at like the end of game 3, you start to figure out where the line is. And you're like, I'm lined up for game 4. And there is no game 4. There is no postseason coming for the Giants. But hey, you got Blake Snell right.
So the Blake Snell thing to me is one of the wildest, most underreported developments of this offseason. This season. You will remember, like, the whole development with it was weird. He was with Jordan Montgomery, Rodriguez not thrown in there, but there was another Diamondbacks pitcher, and I can't remember who it was right now. Regardless, The whole offseason, they went negotiating these deals. They didn't sign until like late February. Blake Snell didn't start the season with the Giants, if you'll remember, because he sustained that injury trying to ramp up so quickly. And then I believe joined them in May. The trajectory of the season for Blake Snell was he came back from that first injury. He was absolutely horrible. I mean, terrible. I think he was pitching to like a 7 ERA. Got injured again, came back again. Then what did he do? Then he pitched to like a 5 ERA. Not very much better. Then he got injured again. And this his most recent stint has been his comeback from that. Jason, before the no-hitter, he was pitching to, I think, a 1.75 ERA. I'm sure that's sub-1 now in the time since he's returned from this injury. There was something wrong with Blake Snell at the beginning of this season, and it showed. And I mean, in his recent starts, you've seen injury, it. The guy, so. What'd you say?
I mean, he did have the oblique injury, so.
And not that injuries are more substantial because of the position that you play. But when we talk about injuries in baseball, Jason, you and I talk about oblique injuries being the biggest wild
card. David Artsma said it. David Artsma came on this show and said that injury is a crippling injury for a pitcher.
It's one that you can deal with in a month or you can deal with in a season. And that's why these things are so tough. I think for Blake Snell, it really was just a matter of taking that time off. The one start between May 27th and July 9th, like that clearly got him right enough to go, you know, 5 innings, 7 innings, 6 innings, 6 innings, and now the no hitter. Blake Snell has been the Blake Snell of old since he got that injury right. It was just a matter of, frankly, to me, the Giants, an organization who you and I have had it out about from different angles on this very show. Mm-hmm. It's an example of them trying to rush a pitcher back who they're paying far too much money.
We got 6 teams in the mix for the National League wild card right now, with the Braves, Padres, and Diamondbacks holding the first three, holding the 3 wild card spots. The Mets only a game back despite losing 2 of 3 to the Angels. The Cardinals are 3 back on the loss side, and the Pirates 3 back on the loss side as we go into the weekend. Paul Skeens had a start on Sunday. Meh. Yeah, I mean, what's it doing? What's it doing for his chances at a Cy Young award and making Sam a whole bunch of money?
So he and Zach Wheeler are both +230. Chris Sale still the favorite, but his number moved. Chris Sale now plus money. He was minus money last week. So just slight movement in that market, not a ton. But Jason, if I looked at you in like, I don't know, the end of May and said, yeah, it looks like there are going to be 3 NL West teams in the playoffs this year. I think you would have looked at me like I have 3 heads. No, the Diamondbacks and Padres turning it around out of nowhere seemingly has been great for baseball. And now here come the Cardinals, who we had so much hope in with these huge contracts and these huge players who still haven't shown out in St. Louis and Goldschmidt and Arenado. They're suddenly roaring back into this wild card race. The Mets are metting. It's a great time in baseball right
I'd now. Have you peeing into a cup if you had told me that we'd have 3 teams coming out of the National League West in the postseason. But it's a real possibility, and the Diamondbacks had a big weekend against the Pirates. That was a big showdown between those two teams who are all going to be in the mix. We mentioned the Giants, by the way. They're probably the last team you would consider – at this point to still have any sort of shot with about 2 months left in the season. The Giants right now, 56-57, 4.5 out of that final wild card spot. The key number there being 5, and that's what they're back in the loss column. So see what the Giants can do. I have to admit something, by the way, full disclosure. I was moving all weekend from Palm Springs, California to our new studios here in Las Vegas. I saw so little sports this weekend outside of the Olympics and a little bit of Yankee baseball yesterday while I was setting up the studio. I had the Yankee game on kind of in the background and I was looking at it. And we'll get to the American League coming up in a second. But I'm not going to lie. I keep it a buck with the audience. Okay, I always keep it a buck with you guys. This was not a weekend where I was like glued to the television watching sports the way I normally would be. Watch some Olympics, the nighttime version, which means you already know what happened. and then a little bit of baseball where I could squeeze it in. Speaking of baseball, we'll get to the American League coming up on the other side. Aaron Judge keeps doing Aaron Judge things. We'll get to that and more next. All right, just about time to put the wraps on this baby for a Monday. Make sure you check out the podcast version of the show. Everything you missed, it's all there for you every day. My exclusive conversation with Tom Brenneman. Had that last Friday for you on Sports Wrap. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, we are on all of them. It looks like a football is sprouting up from my head in this shot, doesn't it? It kind of does. It's kind of weird. We'll have to fix that for tomorrow's show as we've just moved into this new studio setup. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, time for some odds and ends. Odds and ends, focusing on the American League, Sam Yarnell. Yankees win again yesterday. Continue their hot play coming out of the All-Star break. Thanks to the Blue Jays manager yesterday for taking out his starting pitcher, who was throwing a shutout through 4 2/3 innings. Nice move there. Nice move there, Skip. 4 2/3 innings of shutout ball. Nobody on, two outs in the fifth. Takes out his starting pitcher. Yankees rally. Eventually winning in extras after a rain delay. Aaron Judge just continuing to do Aaron Judge things. He was walked 3 times yesterday. The Blue Jays did not want to pitch to him, and I don't blame him. He had home runs in the previous 2 games against them, so the Yankees keep doing their thing. The White Sox are on the complete opposite end of that. They keep doing their thing, Sam Yarnell. 27-87, they've lost 20 in a row. Could they wind up being the worst team in the history of Major League Baseball?
So the worst team in the history of baseball, I believe, is the Mets. It's the Mets.
Yeah.
It's the Mets. 62 Mets, I want to say. And they lost 120-ish games. That's off the top of my head. I don't have the information in front of me. But of course it's the Mets. Just wanted to put that out there. Of course it's the Mets. The White Sox are probably going to be worse than them. I don't know how, well, I do know how Pedro Grifol hasn't lost his job. It's because Jerry Reinsdorf is the worst owner in major American sports and builds each of his teams to, at their peak, go 500 just so he can fill the arena and make his money back. He has no interest in winning championships. It's apparent with how he's run the Bulls over the course of the since Derrick Rose, and it's apparent with how he's run the White Sox in, well, since they were in the World Series. The Chicago White Sox are astronomically bad. I know there may be some baseball fans out there thinking, oh, well, it makes sense the White Sox are losing. We see this all across North American sports these days. They're tanking. They want the number one overall pick next year. Let me tell you something, folks. The collective bargaining agreement that was signed in 2020 between the Major League Baseball Players Association and the owners states that the market size of Chicago dictates that they cannot pick inside the top 10 in this Major League Baseball draft. So there's no reason they're losing. There's no reason for them not to be competitive. With the pieces on that team, think about who this team had coming into the year. Think about the Luis Roberts of the world, who is a great player in Major League Baseball right now. Eloy Jimenez, who, know the Eloy lore, but, you know, he's still fine. Garrett Crochet is a formidable ace in Major League Baseball right now. And the White Sox just dropped the ball. Why? Because they don't want to go out and spend money. It all draws back to the owner in this situation, Jason. But now FanDuel's trying to make money off of them too, because we have this wonderful market on our hands, as you mentioned there. 20-game losing streak, approaching history, I believe. If they lose two more, it'll be the longest losing streak in Major League Baseball history. We've got odds on when their next win will come. As we're recording this on August 5th, their next win to come on this Monday is plus 155. So as you're watching this, check if the White Sox are winning. They're probably not, but it's plus 155 for them to end their 20-game losing streak today. Plus 280 for tomorrow, plus 500 for Wednesday. Then they've got a two-gamer with the Cubs, plus 750 and plus 1600 respectively. And then if you think they're going to lose for another week, they are plus 2500 for their next win to come next Monday against the New York Yankees.
All right, let me drop some knowledge on you. And I don't blame you for not knowing this off the top of your head. The Cleveland Spiders.
Oh.
Worst team in Major League history. National League, 1899. They were 20 and 134. That's good for a 13% winning percentage. They finished 84 games back in their division. I'll do you... now, modern era. Philadelphia A's, 36 and 117. That's good for a 235 winning percentage. Note the number of games, only 153. They finished 54 and a half games out. 1935 Boston Braves, 38 and 115. Then the Mets in 62, 40 and 120, finished 60 and a half games out. And your beloved Washington Senators in 1904 went 38 and 113, 252 winning percentage.
That would be the Texas Rangers. My team is the Washington Nationals.
It's going to wrap it up for us. Can you tell I'm in the mood to play golf? I live in Vegas now. I got to play more golf. It's going to wrap it up for us. Thanks to Sam Yarnell. Thanks to Patrick McEnroe. Thanks to you for watching. We're back at it again on Tuesday with more sports wrap. Maybe the studio will look better too. We'll see you then.